राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय थाद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, वेलकम, गुड मॉर्निंग फ्रॉम अलेचा। स्टिल हियर, वन मोर डे, टुमारो मॉर्निंग लीविंग, मिड मॉर्निंग, मिड डे लीविंग बैक टू नॉर्थ कैरोलिना। सो वी आर हैप्पी टू बी विथ ईच वन ऑफ यू इन इष्ट गोष्ठी, एज वी ऑलरेडी डिस्क्राइब मेनी टाइम्स। बॉम कॉमन, या कॉमन यूनिटी, कम्युनिटी रिवॉल्विंग अराउंड वॉट मेक्स एस कनेक्टेड, वॉट मेक्स एस कॉमन टू इच अदर। So that's the very foundation of community, you know? We all need community. We are individuals, but we are social creatures simultaneously. And as we know, Mahaprabhu's gift somehow or other came to us in the form of Sankirtan, which is a social phenomenon. It's not something that we can do separately, but ourselves. So we need each other. So community is crucial. But community is not just a gathering of people, no? like getting a certain number, but common unity. So ajatiya, in the words of Rupa Goswami, you know, that's very interesting when he describes sadhu sangha. He further qualifies the sadhu sangha that we are to embrace with the term sajatiya, among others. Sorry. Sajatiya, which means like-minded. So we have to agree, like-minded, we have to agree on the fact that we are revolving around this common principle. And even we are agreeing in the revolving around that common center in a certain way, because there are different ways to revolve as well, to circumambulate reality. So here we are in that type of, hopefully that type of gathering, Ishtagosti, this revolving around our Ishta, our worshipable deity, our beloved Lord, God and Goddess, Bhagavan, Bhagavati, Sri Radha Krishna, Sri Gaur Gadadhar and Gaur Lila, and Tadatmya Sangha. Tadatmya Sangha in one way is another way of saying Ishtagosti, basically, right? Getting together with the principle of empathy and with the principle of identifying with, to begin with the commonality, with that which creates this principle of relationship, relationality, community. That's the best way to build community. Build community is not so much about buildings, but about building a certain understanding of what we have in common. And that's the real foundation for whatever may come after. So very blessed to be here with all of you. And these days in Alacha, as you may know, we have been sharing the last week. Well, the last week we didn't have that many lectures like we had last weekend. We have these three lectures on self-love in bhakti, but we have somehow we have been reflecting forward on the implications of that theme, and the importance of self-love in bhakti, for bhakti to be bhakti, and for self-love to be self-love, for both to deserve their names, their particular names. They need to integrate one another. They are not separate entities, what to speak of opposite realities, but actually both affirm one another, because one is the other, basically, self-love and bhakti. So we have been further reflecting on that, as well as in our recent Ishtagosti that we made with local devotees 2 days ago. And today in the afternoon, we will have one more Ishtagosti, one last gathering here in a few hours. So that's it. I'm not seeing any raised hand today, so we'll be having probably the shortest Ishtagosti in the history of Tadatmya Sangha. But now, okay, Rajendra came to save the meeting, so to say.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, Dhanvat Pranam.
Hare Krishna. Hello.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your lectures. I have been hearing your lectures, I mean, quite frequently and regularly. But I have not been able to be regular on Tadatmya Sangha due to timing. It's around 9 here in Nepal. So I try to attend whenever I
Well,
can.
try not to fall asleep. That's a challenge for you in
Sure,
itself. Thank you.
Maharaj,
For that
sir.
effort. Yeah.
Maharaj, your lectures has been, I mean, there have been certain perspective in bhakti. I've been practicing bhakti since 2012, but the way philosophy and everything was presented, it was more or less, you know, my personal experience was more or less dragging my body and mind to be Krishna conscious. It was not so susukham, as we say. There were, I mean, some experiences of, you know, transcendence and some experience of sublime, you know. But the overall experience was more of, you know, austerity, you know, and the way philosophy was presented, like you have to surrender and follow what we say, and you are not supposed to, you know, somewhat think on your own way. So that was kind of difficult for me. But after hearing your lectures in recent, I mean, around 2.5 months, it has been really nourishing for me, and I'm really thankful to you for that. My question is, Maharaj, there is so much importance and emphasis on, you know,
Sorry,
Guru
what? There is so
Tattva
much what?
in emphasis on the importance of Guru Tattva in our Sampradaya. And obviously, I also understand the importance of Guru Tattva, but maybe because of my past experience recently, I'm not, you know, under guidance of any guru as such, Shiksha guru, I mean. So I wanted to say ki, if there is so much importance of guru, and you also mentioned in so many lectures that it is not so much about finding your guru. If you are sincerely practicing, then guru will eventually find you in your lectures, if I am correct. I have heard, I guess. So can you just brief about the, you know, requirement of guru and how we are supposed to find guru, or if we are sincerely trying, you know, praying to Krishna, then eventually Krishna will reveal that this is the person with whom you can, you know, and go ahead in spiritual life.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Rajendra ji. Guru Tatra Ki Jai. And yeah, a few things we can say. Of course, so much can be said about Guru, Guru Tatva, so many perspectives, so many opinions about that, so many ways to address that particular department of reality. Is not that you will hear every single Gaudiya Vaishnava saying the same exact same thing about what guru is, what guru tattva is, how to deal with the guru disciple relationship. There will be different opinions, and I'm not saying only one is correct and everyone else is wrong, because we shouldn't conclude like that. Although there may be opinions which are not, or stances which are not healthy. There's place for toxicity in a relationship between guru and disciple. And like I try to unfold in the chapter on that topic in my recent book on radical personalism. But all of that has to do with the misunderstanding, of course, of what doesn't mean to be a guru, what doesn't mean to be a disciple. The guru tattva is a reality that lends itself to lots of misunderstanding. Not because it's there is some ontological problem with that, but because it's complex. The more you start to study what's guru tattva, what's guru, the more you hopefully realize it's not just a simplistic matter, not that we can just reduce the whole thing to something or someone. Because then we start to border in many cases, overemphasis, reductionism of a whole principle to one person, many times personality cult, and how to approach in that relationship many times also. If there is a misunderstanding again, and I think there's enough evidence in not only in our tradition but in others about toxic ways to relate between teacher and disciple, and of course there are also toxic ways between father and son, mother and daughter, mother and son. I mean, every relationship has their dark potential, so to say, not because there is a problem with their relationship, but because we may have a problem, and we carry that problem to every relationship we may be having. And that's why many times, if we didn't have, and that's sorry to emphasize that, but if someone that didn't have a very healthy initial impressions in one's first and most important relationships in life with one parents, to give an example, probably one will, if that's not addressed, acknowledged, healed, solved, one may be carrying that unresolved filter with oneself and project that into any other relationship with guru, with God, with couples, and so on. We know that that's possible. So, Guru Tattva, I was yesterday thinking, because sometimes this question comes, no, so many times, like which is almost sometimes like a it's not very very how to say very sensitive, no, that who is your guru. No, it sounds like a little violent even. And not only violent in terms of I want to know the answer, but violent in the sense of it's the question in itself is wrongly formulated in one sense, because the question itself implies that you have to reply in singular terms. There is no place to reply in plural terms. Who is your guru? Give me one name. And it's as wrongly formulated as if I ask you, who is your friend? And you will say, well, Maharaj, don't limit myself to the possibility of only having one friend. Why are you asking in singular? Or who is your parent? And you will say, well, at least I have two. And some people may have more than two that were like parents for one's life. So who is your brother? If you have more than one, you will be perplexed by the question. So, but somehow we ask in terms of guru, we many times the way we address the topic by asking who is your guru shows probably a reductionistic understanding of that principle of Guru Tattva, which is not necessarily limited to one person. Which this, of course, I don't want to sound abstract and go into the okay, everything is your guru and can be your guru, so you need no guru in a personal relationship. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that a proper guru will teach you that you shouldn't reduce the whole question to one person, because that's when it starts to become problematic, reductionistic, over focused, overemphasized. You see your guru, I don't know, disconnected from the whole parampara, from their own gurus. Technically speaking, if someone asks me who is my guru, I mean, we can say really, again, first let's address the question in plural. And we, as we were talking recently in the katha we share with Mal Krishna Prabhu on Gadadhar Pandit's appearance. Radhikar Prima Guru, I mean, Sishyanata. Krishna is saying in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sri Radha is my guru, and I'm his disciple. So, and Krishna is known in the Bhagavatam as Jagat Guru, or the guru of all gurus. So it starts to get complicated, right? Because if Krishna is the guru of all gurus, even if I have a guru, human guru that I got initiated from, Krishna is the guru of him, her, and everyone else. So in one sense, Krishna is my guru. But Krishna also has a guru, Sri Radha. So Sri Radha is the original guru. So she is my guru. So I cannot, I mean, when the question comes, who is your guru, I don't want to leave all of them out of the equation. I don't want to leave them out of my answer. The Goswamis are my Shastra, are our Shastra gurus in our tradition. So they are our gurus. One may have a Bhartma Pradarsaka guru, someone who talked first time about Krishna to us. We don't want to leave that person out of the equation. We may have our Param gurus, Param Gurudev, Parat Parat Gurudev, Parameshti Gurudev, which means the guru of my guru, the guru of my guru of my guru, the guru of my guru of my guru of my guru. I don't want to leave Srila Prabhupada, Srila Maharaj outside of my answer, who is my guru. One may have contemporary people who are once Siksha gurus. One's parents can be considered gurus. The notion of gurus extends in so many directions. And ultimately, at least in potential, everything is our guru. That's why the Bhagavatam shows this example of the 24 gurus in the 11th canto, which most of them are so-called inanimate objects. Starts with the earth and animals and elements from nature, and all of them are described as gurus. And again, Srila Sri Master say we would like to enter the land of gurus. So we want to, our goal is to go to a place where everything is our guru. But I will never get to that place if I don't start to teach, to train my vision to see guru everywhere. I won't be able to access the land of gurus if I'm not already in the land of gurus to some degree or another here and now. And eventually, when I see guru everywhere here, I will enter there, the land of gurus. And of course, again, it all may start with one person. And again, I'm not downplaying the importance of having guidance in one's life. I mean, that's paramount in every discipline, not even a spiritual discipline, but in every area of learning. Generally, you go to a mentor, to a teacher, someone who instructs you, has more knowledge, more experience, is more mature, and you can get benefit from that, and there is a interaction and loving relationship, hopefully. So that's there. I'm not here to cancel the whole principle of parampara from now on, because everything is your guru. Yeah, but who has the vision to see that? So it needs to start from someone, and that someone, as we were talking, right? Instead of trying to find guru, try to prepare yourself so you are found by guru. You are reclaimed by the grace department. With this, I mean, I'm not saying don't be open and to the fact that your guru may be close and pray and be attentive. I'm just saying don't go into a cruise control, no, like to a desperate mood of, okay, who is my guru, and try and kind of controlled experience instead of opening to however the original guru, Sri Radha, Bhakti Devi personified, if you want to put it like that, wants to reach you into a certain particular way through a certain particular person. That's how Guru Tattva operates, right? There is an individual, there is a human being, we will call it guru, him, her, but that's in a representational sense. That person is channeling, representing, expressing in our lives God's own reclaiming, so to say, of us. Like Srila Sri Maharaj will say, the searching, the loving searching for the lost servant. So we have to be open for that. We have to be open that grace shows us the way, and that has to happen in a very clear way. It has to be really something overwhelmingly evident for us, self-evident. It cannot be something that I'm not so sure if this is my guru or not, but anyhow, well, ideally, again, probably we may have connected with some gurus in the past from a place which was not the ideal one, and we can still learn the lesson. But ideally, it has to be like an overwhelming confirmation that, okay, Krishna, Radha, the original gurus are coming, are reclaiming me, so to say, are calling me in this particular form, in this particular person. Even, and I will speak for my testimony, even if at some point that particular person no longer represents that call. That doesn't mean that that person didn't represent that call at some point, right? It's not black and white. It's not like, okay, this person, I feel Krishna is inspired and call me through this person now. That doesn't mean that may happen forever. Hopefully, that's the idea, of course. But if it doesn't happen forever, it doesn't mean that it never happened either. So one has to understand how Krishna's will may express itself through so many situations and people in one way or another, and not get overtly like attached that it has to always be in a certain way. So, because if not, we won't be able to notice his call coming from so many other places when it's coming. So I will try to recommend that. And you are talking about a personal experience, right? Rajendra Pratyaksha. And this is very important in this connection, because what will take us to accept one guru or another, or even to take a distance from someone, if unfortunately, unfortunate circumstances come, is one's personal experience at the end of the day. I mean, one has to pay attention to what you are experiencing and feeling. It's not just like, I will accept that guru because someone else is telling me. I mean, I've heard that many times. Like, okay, you should get initiated with this devotee who is a pure devotee. And then, and how do you know it's a pure devotee? Well, because everyone else is saying that. And how do you know that's true? I mean, I'm not denying that may be a pure devotee. I'm just questioning the epistemology, basically, you know, the way you are knowing things. And at the end, it may be just social waves, you know, like everyone is saying something, so that must be true. Well, I do not recommend that method to ascertain the ultimate reality. Just like vox populi, basically, you know, whatever is more popular, whatever the masses are running after, well, that must be the best thing. That's how we. Everyone thinks about everything in many cases, mostly, not everyone, but many people. Whatever most the majorities are doing, let's go there. Well, the majorities are not doing very well, I will say. So be careful with majorities. So at the end of the day, we have to have our own experience, and everything it's gets boils down to your own experience with a certain person. That has to ideally propel you to give yourself to that person. You have to have enough experience with certain person that must propel your surrender to that person. It cannot come by coercion, social pressure, vox populi. All those are superficial reasons, are not enough reasons to justify a life of full surrender to someone. You follow? You have to have an undeniable, overwhelmingly touching personal experience about how that person is coming, Krishna is coming through that person. And it has to be something that goes beyond your usual ways of confirming things, so to say, which many times have more to do with our mind and logic and calculation and fears and comfort zone or things like that. It has to be something that kind of weighs way beyond all that, but at the same time, it's undeniable. It's completely like a new language, but it's so confirming that you cannot but surrender to that. As we were talking recently, the actual ideal preliminary background to surrender is awe and wonder. You have to go through some experience of profound awe and wonder and surrender to that. If you surrender has to come out of wonder, let's put it like that, not surrender out of fear. Surrender out of pressure, surrender out of social fitting in, surrender out of public opinion, surrender out of wonder. Now you have to go through a personal experience that throws you, even unexpectedly, maybe beyond your wildest imagination, throws you to that place of awe and wonder, of witnessing a miracle that is happening, reclaiming you, as we were talking. And you cannot but surrender to that. It's too much. Not to surrender, so to say. No. You have to have such personal experience that you will have to conclude very naturally. The only proper way to respond to that is to give my life to this. If you are not experiencing that, then wait. No rush. You follow, because if not, your surrender may be for the wrong reasons. And that's not surrender, of course. Surrender for the wrong reasons is not surrender. Anything for the wrong reasons is not that thing, right? So we need to wait. It doesn't mean we'll have a miracle. We have to see people flying and see lights, but we have to, yeah, to be drawn to a place of profound wonder, profound awe, profound chamatkar in Sanskrit will be the word, astonishment in how reality is playing out in front of us, how grace is touching us, how we are being taken to very unusual but charming places that we, it's irresistible, basically. We cannot but follow the call. No? That's basically what means that Krishna is all attractive. All attractive means you cannot say no, it's too attractive. You cannot deny, although we may have so many reasons in our head not to surrender, so many fears, so many things not to do, not to, no. But when something of that nature comes, all those reasons collapse, no? Naturally. Huh? And we feel at home, basically. We feel that sense that people call home. So that has been kind of, that should be ideally the epiphany in connection with someone who, that we will feel, okay, that person is my guru. Whether that's someone that I end up getting initiation from, whether it's someone that is someone who came to my life after getting initiation from someone else, and that person continues carrying that torch of inspiration and or whatever. So many things can happen, but whenever that experience is there and I feel called to give myself voluntarily, irresistibly, beautifully, we can say you have met guru. And again, it can be a person, it can be a situation, no? In one sense. I mean, you can learn so much for certain life circumstances. So why don't call them guru, basically? Like we used to say, God comes to your life, this guy, God comes to you disguised as your life. Today we were talking with Bhakti Ras about that in the morning, how that single line includes so much. No? God comes to you disguised as your life. Remember, God is the guru of all gurus. So the ultimate guru is coming through your life circle. In one sense, is to be seen non-different from what happens to you on a daily basis. Therefore, what happens to you on a daily basis is the guru of all gurus coming to you. Is guru. So I think we need to have this more dynamic understanding, not to downplay the connection with the personal agent and human representative, but actually to understand that a proper guru will teach me this type of things. No? And I'm with this, I'm not saying before, because I'm saying that now in this class, I'm a proper guru. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's how it should be. No? Again, a proper guru will never tell you, you just learn from me, stay with me. Of course, there's place for that in the beginning. If you will get, don't have the capacity to deal with diversity and learn from everywhere, and the guru may be more like, hey, pay attention here. Don't get distracted. Just listen to me. Don't listen to anyone else. We are laying the foundation here. But even before that, you should have experienced something with that person that makes you trust that instruction. And yes, okay, let's do it. And eventually, you will be able to deal with many gurus and diversity and lesson from every single direction. So even in principle, maybe a guru will say that to the student. Okay, eventually everything will be guru for you, but so for now, just listen to me, right? Eventually you will develop the capacity to listen from everything and everyone and draw the proper lesson, and you will become a disciple of life, so to say. Life itself will be your guru. Reality will be your guru, and you will be a disciple of everything and everyone. But that's the goal to attain. And we are not yet there. So far now, just listen to me. and I'll try to take you there. Something like that. That has to be the intention of the guru. The intention of the guru is not like, I own you. You only belong to me. You only listen to me for eternity and everyone else is bad. So be careful of everyone else and just come. No, that's not the idea. So that's how it should happen, but pratyaksha has to be there. Pratyaksha is the ultimate pramana, the ultimate source of knowing and evidence is our personal experience. Even when we say shastra is the ultimate pramana, revealed knowledge, It's only so in two ways. One, Shastra is the personal experience of someone else. Let's say the Bhagavatam is Shabda, but the Bhagavatam is Vyasadeva's Pratyaksha. Vyasadeva's personal experience and trance. Jiva Goswami calls that Vaidusha Pratyaksha. The personal experience of someone enlightened, that we call Shabda. That becomes the Bhagavatam. That becomes the Goswami's books. Those are Shabda, but actually they are Pratyaksha. They are the personal experience of the authors in a transrational, enlightened way. So ultimately, there is only Pratyaksha, whether it's ours or others. And even if the Shabda, and I'm finishing with this, the Shabda of the revealed knowledge is the Pratyaksha of the author, we need to have our own Pratyaksha in connection to their Pratyaksha. We need to have our own personal experience of their personal experience. Because if I get in touch with Vyasa's personal experience in the form of the Bhagavatam, but somehow my personal experience is not coming, is traumatizing, is distorted, it's not very nice, I won't take that as revelation. I won't follow what that book says, so to say. So in one sense, their pratyaksha needs to be confirmed by our pratyaksha for us to be able to embrace that. If we are not having a personal experience that is, again, moving enough internally, we won't give ourselves to that. And again, we need to give ourselves for a life, a real life. We need to be able to surrender, not like a forced thing, but we need to reach that place where we can surrender, because that's who we are ultimately. A surrender being is our fully blossomed expression of individuation. So if we haven't reached there, okay, don't need to force ourselves, but we need to know that's it, that's home, that's shelter, that's relief. I can surrender. Oof, I can fully trust. I can be naked. I can be myself without any judgment, any calculation, and I'm being seen for who I am with unconditional love, and I'm being nourished. Okay, that's home. That's surrender, and that's the preliminary foundation to bhakti, to a life of love. You want to fall in love with God? First, you want to construct this mama mandir, this temple of love in your heart. First, we have to lay the foundations properly. And that's surrender, but surrender has to be coming as a result of, again, wonder and this type of thing. So all this applies in relationship to the guru principle, which by extension, again, the guru principle is everywhere, as we mentioned. But even when it begins with one single person, that has to be there for it to be healthy and sustainable. Anyhow, some thoughts, Rajendra. I hope that helps in some way. I have extended myself a little bit. I think I'm realizing that I generally extend myself more with the first question than the other. So it's a pattern I'm realizing now.
Thank you, Maharaj. That was really helpful.
Thank you.
Maharaj, is there any way I can get in touch with you? I don't know how much available
Yeah,
you will
yeah, yeah. You have my email. You can contact my email or by Facebook or something.
Yeah, I'm connected with you on Facebook.
Okay, you can send me a message there then.
Okay, Maharaj. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. So we'll go to the next question, which is a question from Mark. So Mark, if you can unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Mark. First time I think we are meeting, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's very
Okay.
good to see you, my brother.
Thank you. My pleasure to meet you and welcome.
I don't really have a question. I just have you've fallen into my algorithm, and
Okay.
I've been listening to these, and
Okay.
it's resonated very deeply with me. It's the same sort of conclusions I've had with my experience through ISKCON from 1979, so it's a long time ago.
Okay.
So I really don't have a question. I just want to represent that I'm out here, that you reached me,
Wow.
and that I really, really value this, and I continue to listen to you. And that's all. I just wanted to represent. I usually listen on YouTube when it's after the live.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. That was moving and appreciated not only your presence. Sorry,
I just wanted to say that we're out here and here.
That's important to know. Thank you. Thank you. That makes the whole thing
Yes.
even more concrete and more radically personal, as I like to say. So, because as I used to say, for me, sometimes it's a little overwhelming. The fact that I know that there's people maybe listening to me and getting to know me somehow, and I don't have a clue about their existence, basically. Like
Right,
you.
right.
I mean, till today, I didn't have a
That's why I'm
clue
here.
of the existence of Mark in Olympia. So I'm not able to be aware of that, to properly honor your presence and reciprocate in some way, at least by being aware of your good existence. So I need all of you to show up and engage me in that reciprocation and therapy. So I can just somehow like catch up with the reciprocity of the interaction. So thank you. I appreciate that your words and your showing up and your presence, and of course, more than invited to continue being part of it, whether live now or however you can connect. And I'm humbled to somehow be of inspiration or of service to you and others. It's, again, it's all grace acting upon us, through us. It's not our own making as separate beings, because nothing like that actually exists. So to think that we are separate beings, like leading the show and all that stuff, is just a madness and illusion. So I'm happy that people like you showing up is a healthy reminder for me of how grace can do miracles even through me. So that gives hope, and that's a powerful confirmation of how grace operates and reaches hearts even beyond one's imagination. So thank you. I appreciate that. That was a very desired contribution to the table in today's gathering. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, so we'll continue now with the next raised hand, which is Anutam Chitra. So please, you can unmute yourself.
Pranams, Maharaj. So
Pronounce.
actually, I have been listening to one of my mentors. They've been giving a lecture series on Bhagavad Gita, whereby we were processing what are the different processes of yoga and how Bhakti Yoga is like the crest jewel in between those, I mean, the first six chapters and then the later six chapters. And somewhere along the lines, around seventh chapter, where I think the Lord begins by saying that though someone may be practicing the path of transcendence for multiple births, they may still not be able to achieve perfection. And I think there is, hardly one knows me in truth. So that's the statement the Lord makes. And in context of that, they were explaining how the path of Bhakti Yoga is also not very easy. It's sudurlabha. So it's rare, because it has the potency to even control Krishna. And I just read through Nectar of Devotion, and there I think Prabhupada had also mentioned that pure devotional service on some level is stronger than the Lord himself, because that is his internal potency. So but then recently I've also been hearing how unconditional the love of God is for everyone. So to me, this sort of seems opposite. Like, on one end, the Lord is unconditionally loving and is willing to reach out. And then there's another section or another part where I hear that bhakti is sudurlabha. So how do we sort of process that, Maharaj?
Thank you. And I must say, I appreciate your questions, because generally your questions bring this type of apparent contradictions. And that's important, because that shows, I mean, that shows not that you're wanting to put me in a complex situation, but that you are willing to see those apparent contradictions and willing for reconciliation, like trusting there must be a way to synthesize these things, but also willing to point at those and share, okay, I don't understand. It seems contradictory. What to do with this? Instead of, I'll cherry pick this one. It's more comfortable for me. I like this and I won't see the other one and just stick with this one. Which of course, Srila Rupa Goswami says in Lagu Bhagavatamrita, which is, that's not the thing you have to do. No? When two things seem to contradict in Shastra, we cannot cherry pick and just stay with one. We have to reconcile them. Tattu samam bhayat. Also, that's what Vedanta Sutra is saying. In the third aphorism, Vedanta Sutra says, Shastra yonitvat. No? The scriptures are like the womb from which knowledge about the absolute comes. But then the next sutra says, Tattu samam bhayat. We are to understand the scriptures in the spirit of reconciliation. I mean, you will need to reconcile stuff from Shastra. That's basically the idea. No. Revealed knowledge comes from there, but you need to reconcile things that seem to be contradictory, but they are not. And by that reconciliation, we gain access to deeper understanding, to deeper level, to bigger pictures, and we develop a more reconciliatory, whatever, if that word's exact, reconciling view and eye to address Shastra and to address everything actually. Instead of seeing just contradiction, because in one sense that's the, and I'm going to your question in a minute, I'm not escaping from that, just creating some foundation to that. But in many ways we live our lives many times in that sense, like with very unintegrated things, like this is bad, this is wrong, this is black, this is white, and this is contradictory. And there may be things that are contradictory, but the point is, the more we grow, the higher we go, the more capacity we have to reconcile, integrate, coexist with paradox, for example. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, we may not be very able to coexist with things that seem paradoxical, seem contradictory, but I mean, our whole metaphysics, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, is called achintya bheda abheda, which basically means, achintya means paradoxical in one sense. It's inconceivable, paradoxical, bheda bheda, one and different. Huh? For a dualistic mind, it's not possible. It's one or it's different. It cannot be the two at the same time. Well, it is. And that's what reality is about. It's paradoxical oneness and difference. So again, my point is, if we don't train our mind to deal with paradoxes, to reconcile apparent contradictions, we will live in a very fragmented worldview. Now, we will have a very fractured cosmovision way of dealing with reality instead of integrative. When you ultimately you realize, of course, nothing is separate, nothing exists in its own orbit, everything is interconnected with this common center that we were talking in the beginning, common unity. So my point with all this is, again, I appreciate your question, because it invites us to reconcile. And by that reconciliation, it's not just, okay, this particular doubt is solved, but somehow we train our mind to think in those terms beyond that particular question or quote, and apply that to other sections of scripture, but to reality at large. You know, like, okay, this seems contradictory. Should I quickly label that as contradictory and just cherry pick my favorite and stay with that in my comfort zone? Or should I try to develop a bigger picture and integrate and reconcile whatever comes on my way? You know? And of course, the latter is the option. So that's it. Regarding your question, which basically seems to be how to harmonize those statements in Shastra, which on one side seem to say bhakti is very easy and joyful to be practiced, and Krishna is so merciful and accessible and so on and so forth. And on the other side, sections that seem to say bhakti is difficult to attain Or the verse you quoted, which is a famous verse, third verse of chapter 7, Manushyanam Sahasrasu, Kaschid Yatati Shidaye Yatatama Apishidanam Kaschim Mambeti Tattvataha. No? Well, Krishna is saying, again, if improperly addressed, this verse may seem quite discouraging or even elitist. Now, of many thousands of men, one may endeavor for perfection, and those who have achieved perfection, hardly once knows me in truth. So it seems like, oops, I hope I would like to be that person, but I don't know if I will qualify for that. So it can create an effect of discouragement instead of like, as I will say many times, we are already saved. Because at the same time, we have to put everything on the scale, right? When we find this verse, for example, we shouldn't get like over obsessed only with that verse to the point that we lose sight about everything else that is being said in that same text, not what to speak of other texts. So let me bring into the picture some other things said in the Gita, and then we'll try to bring some reconciliation. Because again, if we just limit ourselves to this verse or to the word Sudurlabha, and we don't see everything else, we will interpret that out of context. We are taking the other thing, that verse, out of context. So Krishna, for example, chapter 2, verse 40, if I'm not mistaken, say, Neha vikramana asusti pratyabhayana vidyate svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahatovaya. One who engages in bhakti, in this process of bhakti, there is no loss nor diminution, he's saying. And swalpam apyasya dharmasya, and even the slightest engagement with this dharma, bhakti dharma premada, protects you from the greatest danger. So that seems to be on the other direction, right? More generous. Again, I don't want to create, they are going in different directions. It seems to be, but this direction. Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, of course, 9:30 and 31. 9:30, he says, Apichet suduracharo bhajante mama nanyabak sadurdeva samamtabhya samyabhyabhyasito hisa. Even if you are of very bad behavior, but you are sincerely surrendering to me, for me you are already a sadhu. And then he goes on the next verse, overflowing that saying, Kantiya pratiya nihi name bhakta pranashyati, the conclusion of the verse, which basically means, O Arjuna, declare boldly that my devotee never perishes. So it's giving this assurance, you will not perish, which is another way of saying you are saved. In my ears, that sounds like you are saved. You will never perish. You're already on your way home, and I'll protect you. I mean, that's the main anga of Sharanagati. Goptri tui vananam, and rakshishati ti vishvas. Trust that Krishna will protect you and that you are being maintained by Krishna. That's the main expression of surrender. To accept that Krishna is maintaining me. In the Gita, he said, Yoga Kshemam Bahamyaham, 9th chapter. I provide to my devotee what they lack, I keep what they have. No? So if my devotee lacks, it doesn't mean only he lacks chapati, I will provide puri and halava. So I will be especially merciful. No? He lacks certain love for me, I'll provide that. That's the ultimate providence, right? What is being provided. So all these verses are showing Krishna's very intense grace and giving of himself. So how to understand these verses that seem to say otherwise? Well, for me, the answer is quite simple, and hopefully it's for you as well. When bhakti is being said to be sudurlabha, it doesn't mean that bhakti is sudurlabha. That sudurlabha means like very difficult to attain, or sometimes some may describe it as very difficult to practice. And the point is, in nature, bhakti is not difficult, but we are difficult. And therefore, bhakti is difficult for us. Not that bhakti is difficult in nature and likes to be difficult for us so we never attain it or something like that. It's not like that. No, it's not like Krishna is difficult to attain and he doesn't want to be attained. I've heard that from devotees, and that's not correct. No, like you quoted Nectar of Devotion, Krishna is conquered by bhakti, right? So I've heard devotees saying, because Krishna is conquered by bhakti, he makes it very difficult so you don't conquer him because he doesn't want to be conquered. And it's like, wait a minute, you have really gone astray here. How can you say that Krishna doesn't like to be conquered by bhakti? I mean, that's his favorite version of himself, so to say. That's where he is in his greatest form. That's what he likes to do the most, to serve his devotee. I mean, ham bhakta parad, you know, hi ashtatantri vadu, he says in the bottom, I'm the devotee of my devotee, I have no independence, he says. People know me as the supremely independent, but to be honest, I'll tell you a secret. I have no independence. I'm totally captured by my bhaktas. Sukadeva Goswami describes that in the Bhagavatam. He says, Bhagavan bhakta bhaktimam. What does Bhagavan mean? The word Bhagavan, Bhakta Bhaktimam. He's the Bhakta of his Bhaktas. He's Bhagavan. Generally, we think Bhagavan is the all-powerful, all-opulent Lord. And he is. But on top of that, more confidentially, he's the lover of his lovers, the devotee of his devotees. That's who he likes to be, mostly. So it's contradictory. That's a contradiction to say, no, but Krishna makes bhakti difficult, so you never attain him, so he doesn't have to be controlled by you in love. No? That doesn't speak so nicely about God. So when we find these statements or the verse of the Gita that you were referring to, it's not so much about talking how difficult bhakti is, but how difficult it may feel for us at times because of how difficult we are. No, because again, we come with our baggage of complexities and trauma and resolved stuff and resistance to grace and fear of giving up, of surrender. And we have to deal with that also with self-compassion and self-loving bhakti. But yeah, like I was talking before about surrender. To speak about surrender for some of us is very complicated. It's very difficult because that entails giving ourselves trust, full confidence, and if we have some complex experience with that stuff, that's not easy. Just hearing the word surrender triggers trauma in many cases. So if that's the preliminary stage of bhakti, what must then bhakti be about? And it's like, oh my God, that's not. So that's one way of explaining that. It's not that bhakti is complicated. Bhakti is simple, but we are not simple. That's why people like great personalities like Gaur Govinda Maharaj, they will describe, and even Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta and others, Vaishnavism, synonym for Vaishnavism is Saralata, which means simplicity. So to be a Vaishnava means to be simple. To be a Bhakta means to be simple. Because why? Because Bhakti is simple. So to practice Bhakti, you have to be simple. If you are not simple, Bhakti is complicated. And you cannot practice it, right? So like once there's this famous quote that people say, like, okay, to love is simple, but to be simple is complicated, right? So reality is simple, but to be simple, that's not easy, because we are very complicated. We overcomplexified our existence. So we are now in the process of decomplexification of our existence. No, that's another way of talking about dualism and non-dualism. No, when our mind gets dual, it's not get only dual, but trial and four, three, two, four, five. I mean, it gets so divided, so fragmented, so complicated that we need to bring it to simplicity, which means let's bring our conceptions back to Sambandha. Everything is interconnected. Everything is one. Simplify. No? Go back to that one. Like everything is one in that sense, no? Not in an impersonal sense, but everything is not separated. Ultimately, it's tied, it's connected. Be simple in that sense, instead of the complexity of seeing everything separated and alienated from each other. To keep that vision is what makes the practice of bhakti difficult. Because bhakti tends towards the integration of that complexity. And to become simple. That's one of the ways to describe a Vaishnava, someone who is simple. And it's simple for the simple. Prabhupada will say that. Bhakti is simple for the simple. So, and then you understand Susukam Kartum. Gita says chapter 9. No, bhakti is to be executed with lots of joy, or sometimes it's translated as easily, organically, in a simple way. But you need to have these things in place. That's one way of explaining all this. And one more thing I will say, when we hear Sudurlabha, which sometimes is also difficult to attain, again, it's not that bhaktis or Krishna's mercies in denial of giving themselves to us. Again, they are so merciful, and we have talked about that so many times, and there are so many quotes in Shastra. I won't torture you with that now. But we are the difficult, no? So in that sense, bhakti is difficult. Or Sudurlabha many times is describing to Bhava Bhakti. For example, when Rupa Goswami is describing the different stages of bhakti, sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prem bhakti, he says bhava bhakti is Sudurlabha, difficult to attain. With this, the spirit of this statement is not so much you will not attain it, but just do not make it cheap. Do not take it for cheap. No, like, understand that Bhava Bhakti is basically the preface to Prem Bhakti. You are almost there in one sense. So that may take some time. You're already doing bhakti, but it may take a few lifetimes. Do not cheapen the process. So to understand that to fully experience a life of ecstatic service to Bhagavan, there has to be some investment on your part. So unless and until we are willing to do so fully, it will take some time. So in that sense, it may be difficult. It's not that Krishna is unwilling to give that. It's not that bhakti herself is unwilling to give herself. They are absolutely willing to do so. And that's why we are here, actually. No? Because as we were also talking some weeks ago with Sumati and Bhakti Rasa, I mean, technically speaking, and as another conversation, but the soul is under the influence of Maya Shakti since time without beginning. Which in itself is complicated to think about, anadi karma. So you can imagine that for uncountable lifetimes, we have been acquiring samskaras and different tendencies of many times dualism and separation from God and exploitation and so on. So much, uncountable lifetimes. So you can say, wow, there is no hope then. I mean, I'm absolutely lost. But somehow or other, we are here today, talking about all this and embracing bhakti. So that shows, in one sense, the power of bhakti and the willingness of bhakti to give itself. For me, that's a confirmation, actually, the fact that we can be talking now here about it, the confirmation of how, despite so many lifetimes of looking in other directions, we can be in this lifetime with this inspiration of going deeper and deeper. So that confirms for me the willingness for Krishna Bhakti to give itself to others. So it may be difficult, again, for the difficult ones, or it may be difficult. That's mostly the spirit of these statements. No? When it's difficult, invites us to ask ourselves, why it's difficult for me? Because we will see other people who embrace Bhakti from a very natural, organic place, easy. So that shows that, okay, that's not difficult. In that case, it's not difficult. So why for me it's difficult? And then you're invited, of course, to find the answer to that question and do the needful. So yeah, that will be basically my explanation. So I don't know if that helps to reconcile this particular layer of reality.
Yes, Maharaj. Like how you pointed out that Krishna is merciful, like it reminded me of that was that, hey, Krishna, Karuna, Sindhu, and then only I was like, oh, ocean of mercy. But then I also hear this. I mean, that doesn't sound like ocean of mercy when it is put in that way. So, yes, Maharaj, like now it's starting to make more sense, Maharaj.
Yeah, yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. We have to keep the ocean of mercy as it is, no? Oceanic. Krishna's mercy is oceanic. So Let's keep His mercy oceanic always, because that's our hope. The moment we cancel that, we lose, basically. And yeah, but I appreciate the question and the importance of, again, if we have two statements that one is contradicting the other, we have to do something with that, right? Because if not, we are practicing with a contradictory notion. Again, one class I hear, okay, Krishna is an ocean of mercy. And another class I may be told, he doesn't want you to attain bhakti because he will be controlled by you. He doesn't like that. And that creates a short circuit in the system, because how someone who is an ocean of mercy behave in this other way? And we need to solve that urgently, because if not, we are creating a contradictory idea of who Krishna is. And what to speak if on top of that, we add another contradiction, another contradiction. At one point, Krishna will make no sense to us. Our idea of Krishna, not Krishna, our idea, our misrepresentation of Krishna will say, like, this is too much contradictions to keep in one single person. That this cannot be God. I'm leaving this whole stuff now. That can happen. So we need to, on our way, solve and integrate, or that is a way of securing our faith, so to say, of having a reasonable faith, a commonsensical faith, really, that makes sense to us. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Arad.
Okay, we have two more hands raised. So let's go to Svetadvip Radhika and Amanda Bikram Prabhu. You can unmute yourself. Pranam, nice to see you both.
Pranam.
Nice to see you, Amanda Bikram Prabhu, closer to the camera. Thank you.
Yeah, changed location, so he's closer.
Yeah, it's a different background. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never saw that fridge before. Yeah, you're right.
It's warmer, so we're moving closer.
Ah,
to
I see. I see. I see. Okay. Okay. So, something to share today.
Maharaj, recently I was noticing that like we have the tendency to practice our sadhana or do service on like a feel good factor, you know, like, oh, today I had a good japa, like my japa was good, or like, you know, kind of evaluate our like service and sadhana. I remember you also mentioned something about it in your book, like Radical Personalism, that we shouldn't be doing service to feel good or feel something, rather feel something so you can do service, you know, something like that. And also I think in your recent Q&A, you were quoted from Swami Sadananda about don't read unless it's like, you know, you're like inspired, something along those lines. So I understand that, like, yeah, we want to, like, you know, do japa or sadhana, a service from a place of love and devotion, like wholeheartedly inspired. So what, like, I'm really trying to understand what the transition is like, you know. I'm thinking it's not overnight, like, you know, today I realize this and tomorrow, like, you know, it's a completely, like, you know, different different place. I'm thinking the transition, you know, like, it might be a bit tricky, because, you know, I don't want to, like, just stop doing things and be lazy, you know. So how do we, like, understand that we do the transition, like, properly?
Okay, thank you. Okay, lots to unpack there. So thank you, that's great. And it's an important question for sure, yeah. So, of course, I imagine some of you may have heard all those things that Svetadip Radhika referred to in quoting me, but I'll just briefly re-mention and explain that. One side, yeah, I mentioned something along those lines in Radical Personalism, like we should try to do bhakti to feel something, but we should try to feel something to engage in bhakti. Now, in other words, my point there, of course, is bhakti is not just a feel good, as you were saying, feel good practice. No, I understand on some stage that may be there, and it's okay. Krishna is merciful enough to allow that. I mean, he himself, when he mentions chatur bhida bhajante mam, Manusmriti Artarthi. Now he will mention Artarthi and Arti also. Like he who looks for money or he who is afflicted, one of among other people, they surrender, they give themselves to me. They approach me, suffering. So of course, if someone approaches Krishna suffering, the implication is they want to stop suffer, right? That's the implication. They approach with the intention of feeling good, in other words. Now, so there is place for the feel good approach. Initially, on some level, Krishna say, okay, now you need relief, you need shelter, you need some peace of mind. I mean, who doesn't need that on some level? If that's not there on some level, we cannot engage in bhakti. I mean, if you are extremely disturbed, extremely dysfunctional, you need to have that in place first. And Krishna will say in the Gita, how can we talk of happiness, of a happiness without peace? No, I mean, real happiness entails peace. No, it's not, if I just look for happiness without peace, that's not happiness. That's just intensity, emotional intensity. Again, dopamine peak. But the real happiness has as its foundation peace. No, so sometimes we need peace to begin with. Not because peace for us is the goal of life, but that will serve as a foundation to engage in a balanced way and be more able to focus in our offering, so to say, of our lives in bhakti to Bhagavan and so on. So that was the spirit of that quote. Like, try to feel something to serve instead of just try to serve to feel something. Like implying, try to feel something to serve, try to serve with the right motivation. That's my point. Don't serve without feeling anything. If you say, I don't feel anything, but I force myself to serve, that's not so healthy. And that goes to this quote from Swami Sadananda, that I have it here again. I'll read it again for those who didn't hear it. He says, and I will, again, this has to be contextualized as I tried to do the other day. Read only when you have the incentive to do so. Do everything that comes from your heart, from Shraddha in his seva, not under compulsion. So again, the spirit of this is, if you're, the spirit of this is not, if you don't feel anything, don't do anything. No. Okay, I don't feel like chanting japa today, so I won't chant because I don't feel anything. No, the thing is, if you don't feel anything for chanting japa, don't force yourself to do that, but spend some minutes asking why I don't feel anything. And then chant japa. You follow my point? It's not so much about stop doing it, but stop doing it for the wrong reasons. Take a pause, question yourself, be introspective, and then restart for the right reasons. That's the spirit of here. It's not just, okay, now I find the one-liner that will justify all my laziness forever because I don't feel anything, so I won't do anything. No, you don't feel anything, then that's inviting you to ask yourself why I don't feel anything. Take a time, be introspective, write, pray, and then do. Do something with the right feeling, with the heart in the right place. Oh, like GPS, no? Recalculating, so to say. Right. So I will say that's a transition. When we are not feeling something. I mean, I'm not against feeling something. Again, the important thing is, what do we do with that? Because you ultimately, bhakti entails lots of emotions. Again, bhava bhakti, we are entering to a land of emotion. Technically speaking, the land itself will be made of emotion, according to our philosophy. You know, Golok is not a planet made of material ingredients. It's a planet made of bhava. It's planet made of emotions. The earth feel Krishna, the trees, every single atom there is vibrant with divine love. So you want to enter a planet of emotions. So we have nothing against emotions and feeling something. But just the question is, what do I do with those emotions? Again, they are not just for my own enjoyment. Okay, I will take all my ecstasy and swallow it for myself, so to say. That's not the idea. No, it needs to be given. That's the nature of love. And everyone is given. Everyone is thinking that same term. Everyone is thinking in terms of, I want to serve everything and everyone here. And of course, that's how you end up receiving what you need, because everyone else is thinking that same thing. So you receive everyone else's service and love. It's not that you calculate that in being there, but that's how it happens. This is the famous, like, it's not a story, but just an example that one person once, maybe you heard that, says, okay, I like to see heaven and hell. I like a trailer of both, just to inform my prospect and see where I choose to go. So the person, okay, was taken to hell first. And everyone was there. You may have heard this. And everyone had like these giant spoons, and giant pots with food. And everyone was suffering miserably because they were trying to take this with the spoons and take the soup, let's say, whatever, from the, but the spoons were so large, so long, that they couldn't bring the spoon back to their mouth. They were trying to do that. So they were suffering miserably, hunger and anxiety. Okay, that was hell's darshan. So let's go now to heaven. So he goes to heaven and he sees the same people with the same spoons, with the same pots, but all of them were chubby and happy. No, they were not dying of hunger. And he said, like, what's the difference? It's exactly the same thing. Why one place is hell, the other is heaven? And then the person showed, the guide showed him, look again. And what they were doing is each one was taking the soup, but was giving to each other to eat instead of trying to feed themselves. So everyone was feeding each other, and naturally everyone's needs were attended, so to say. That's a way of showing, highlighting the psychology in one place or another. So why I ended up here? Sorry, remind me. I got lost and found and lost. Transition and introspection and not feeling. Oh, feeling. I was talking about feeling and in the feeling, what to do with the feeling. Yeah, these meta narratives can be tricky sometimes. So yeah, the feeling is always to be offered to others, is in service to others. We don't want just to feel something for ourselves. It doesn't work, even if you try. You feel something, you're trying just to capture that feeling and keep it only for yourself. It starts to evaporate because that confirms you don't exist as an alienated unit. So whatever you have is to extend to others as you are extended what others have. That's the ideal reality. So meanwhile, as long as we are not there yet, and sometimes we may approach our practice, our daily sadhana, and we may not feel like super motivation, we are invited to enter this transition of introspection. Now, that's how I like to understand the three first advices that Srila Rupa Goswami gives in Upadeshamrita verse number 3. Three. Utsaha nischayat dhairyat. Tat tat karma pravartanat sangas sityagat sato vritte sadvit bhaktir prasidite. He recommends there are six things to nourish our bhakti. First one is utsaha, which is be enthusiastic. So it's like, okay, let's be, but I'm not enthusiastic today. I'm not enthused today. So here goes the second advice. Utsaha nischayat. Try to practice with some determination, trying to engage and try to focus. And enthusiasm will come as a result of that. And you say, okay, I'm doing it. It's not happening. Enthusiasm is not coming. So then he said dhairyat, which means be patient. So be patient doesn't only mean wait, but try to think about it. Try to be introspective. Try to use this opportunity to go deeper into why you are not feeling enthusiastic. And when you engage in that inner dialogue, eventually you will find some answer to that. You will find some reason, some clarity, and that clarity will be enthusiasm, basically. And so for me, that's the idea when Rupa says, be patient. It's not so much just like, wait, 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 and magically something will happen. It's like when you say someone, be tolerant. And if you ask, but by why I have to be tolerant, and nobody explains you why, it doesn't work. You cannot tolerate a situation that you don't understand why to tolerate. But if you're explained why one should be tolerating whatever this, oh, yeah, now I find a purpose. I can ascribe a purpose to that, and that becomes a source of growing and learning through that, instead of like, this makes no sense. So it's important, this idea of purpose, bringing purpose into the picture. So if I feel nothing before chanting, or not nothing, but even if you tell me, I don't know, Maharaj, I feel nothing for chanting, and I say, oh, you feel something. You feel that you don't feel anything. So start there. You are feeling something. You feel that you don't feel anything. And because of that, you feel frustration, or you feel lots of things, actually. So what to do with that? So I will say that, no? And as we were talking in that lecture you referred to, Sweta de Pradika, we were saying that sometimes our journey, at least on certain stages, will oscillate between like inspiring grace or inspiring hope and humbling failure. And inspiring hope and humbling failure. So failure, I'm not saying that it's failure actually, but you may feel I'm failing, or you may feel I'm not feeling anything, I don't have enthusiasm. But all that has to be humbling. It's a way of invoking humility and taking us to a place of why I'm not feeling anything, what's happening. Not to chastise ourselves, what's wrong with me as a soul, there must be some ontological defect in me and I'm crap. No, we talked about self-love in Bhakti. Don't forget those lectures, please. Whatever I'm saying has to be taken in the context of whatever else I'm saying in other lectures. So, but introspection and questioning in a healthy way. And if I'm not feeling something, also another way of taking it is, well, actually, maybe I'm not feeling something because this is a great opportunity for me to chant, concentrating on, I want to make Krishna feel something. I want to absolutely concentrate on making them feel something with my offering, even when I don't feel anything. That will be a special offering, I can tell you. Now, if you are on one of those days that you feel, I don't feel anything, and you really make an effort to, okay, this must be an arrangement for me to concentrate on making them feel something with my feeling nothing. I'm trying to pray and to give myself in a pleasing way with humility and sincerity. Wow. Probably that's a deeper offering than when you feel something. Because sometimes we feel something and we get attached to that. And we start like to enjoy that for ourselves. Oh, I'm inspired, I'm this. Oh. But when you don't feel anything, and nonetheless you try to make an effort to make them feel something in that moment, you can imagine that Radha and Krishna are taking special note of that offering. And you can imagine that the result of that will come, will make you feel something. But yeah, the end of the conclusion is, this is not so much about me feeling something, but they feeling something. Of course, that's the goal. When you are so much in love that you are just concerned to loving and giving, we may not be there and we may need to feel something. I'm not denying that on certain stage. But even when that's not happening, again, these are ways that we can navigate this transition. I don't know if that makes any sense to the Pradhika.
Yes, Maharaj, that's very, very helpful, actually. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Of course, there are so much more things we can always say, but today's a gift that came, whatever may be a gift for you, is a gift that came to me, so it's not my own fabrication either. So thank you. And we have one more raised hand from Daniel and Brianna. So welcome to both of you. Finally, surprised that you were able to make it today, because they are never able to be part of this live because some engagement they have there. And we met personally a few days ago, and okay, it's beautiful to see you live today. Welcome.
Yeah. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Just a
quick question. I've been told that if I don't chant or pray aloud, then that's somehow impersonal. Is there any truth to that?
If you don't chant what aloud, sorry?
I don't chant or pray, yeah, aloud, that it's somehow impersonal. Is there any truth to that?
So in brief, my reply is no. Yeah, I will say, of course, no, I will say that to begin with. But something that I say in this connection and other things, because sometimes devotees come and I heard this, I was told that, and sometimes these things are widely non-shastric, basically. They contradict everything the scriptures say. So sometimes it's good to say, so where does it say such a thing in the scriptures? No, like to really trace back to some form of concrete evidence instead of, oh, I heard and this tell me and that tell, and you know how this type of paramparas comes, you know, these chains of, he told me he heard from, and on the way it got so distorted, probably originally was something else. So no, why that will be impersonal? Or other question that I will ask if someone comes to with that to me. First, I will say, where is that in Shastra? And second, it's like, why? Why not doing it aloud is impersonal? I mean, give me an explanation to that that makes sense to me. Why doing it aloud is personal and doing it whispering or mentally is impersonal? And of course, from that going on, we will say, okay, so it seems that Haridas Thakur was a Mayavadi then, because in Chaitanya Charitamrita it clearly say that he chanted 3 lakhs, 1 lakh aloud, 1 lakh upamsu, which means whispering, and 1 lakh manasika, which means mentally. So he chanted 64 rounds mentally, so he must be a pretty big impersonal guy. No, that will be maha aparat to Haridas Thakur, the Namacharya. No. So again, we have to play out these type of things with everything else that is being told in Shastra. So if someone tells you, okay, chanting not allowed is impersonal, you have to put in the scale, okay, but this is being told about the acharya of the chanting, of the name, and he does it. 1/3 of that is mental, total silence. 1/3 of that is not allowed, is whispering. So most part of his chanting is not allowed. And he's the Namacharya. So how can he be impersonal? We have to develop this type of like logic and way of thinking. So whenever we receive, of course, sometimes we may not know those statements, but the more we get aware of those, we have to integrate them. So the contradictions show itself for what it is, so to say. And one is forced to really be commonsensical and be coherent with all the different statements. So no, it's not impersonal. I mean, why? No, I mean, and you can be chanting and praying aloud, and you can be impersonal. Again, it's not about doing it aloud or not. It's what's going on inside. So you can be, I mean, technically speaking, let's be as specific as I can. Impersonalists who subscribe to the impersonal doctrine, Advaita Vedanta and Sankaracharya, many of them do kirtan. So they are chanting aloud and they are officially impersonalists. And of course, we can be doing that as Gaudiya Vaishnava. We can be impersonal in so many ways, as I try to mention in radical personalism. So I can be doing kirtan aloud at the top of my lung with 3 microphones and be impersonal in so many ways. And someone can be praying silently in their chamber, in their cave, and not saying a word, but dropping some sincere tears of offering of a heart. And that's, wow, I mean, will you dare to call that impersonal? I wouldn't. So again, many people say many things. We cannot stop that from happening. The thing is that we have the proper common sense and filter to understand them, or even if we are concerned or confused or we would like to clarify, we can question about them, bring them to question in a healthy way, like all of us are doing here, which I really appreciate. I mean, this is, it's important that we how to say, we give ourselves permission to ask these things instead of, you cannot ask that. How you dare to ask such a question? You should be ashamed of you. And we don't ask anything of that, and that becomes, that's the problem. So yeah, no single Shastri quotation, no single evidence saying that doing it something in silence means to be impersonal. No. And again, someone would say, no, it's because impersonalists meditate a lot in silence. Again, they do kirtan as we do externally, loudly as we do. So, and we have our own silent practices. I mean, there's nothing against silence. I shared in Radical Personalism, if you may recall. If not, I'm looking for the quotation here. But there are a few things about silence that are quite in line with our, I mean, there, our tradition is about silence a lot. For example, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, verse 38, he says, among all secrets, I'm silence. So he identifies himself with silence. How can you say, okay, Krishna's been impersonal in that moment, right? And among all secrets, I'm silence. So he's connecting silence with something secret, which tends to be something deep and valuable. And silence a lot has to do not with not speaking, but with hearing attentively. So I can pray and meditate in silence, trying to hear Krishna's voice. So that's not impersonal. That's the opposite of that. For example, Prabhupada, in the commentary to this verse of the Gita 10:38, and I'm giving the quotation so those who think I'm just creating something out of the blue can go there. Prabhupada says, I'm reading from the quote of my book, among the confidential activities of hearing, thinking, and meditating, silence is most important, because by silence, one can make progress very quickly. Now you have to counteract that one. Srimad Bhagavatam 7, Canto, chapter 15, verse 77, says that Krishna is worshipped by silence, literally. Anyhow, I don't want to, again, bring all this parade of quotes, but just for us to know, that's there in the scripture. No? So again, now we are maybe more equipped if someone comes and says, you are being silent in your prayer, you are impersonal. Krishna says this, Bhagavatam says that, Prabhupada says that. So we have to understand all these things, yeah, in a more and more nuanced way. So all that to say, in my reply, no. That was just the unfolding to my original no. So thank you for your question, Daniel and Brianna. And nice to see you present today and all of you. So we'll conclude today. It's already 1 hour and 30 minutes. So I think we have enough to continue processing and playing out in practice till we see each other next week. But also, just brief announcement for those of you who have time. Tomorrow, in the context of our Tadatmya bi-weekly lectures, I'll be giving a lecture this time on a topic I'm writing about, actually, my next book, and it's connected to evolution and Vedanta. And I will be sharing a few thoughts. I plan to share in more detail next month, probably doing one class per week for the whole month, but this will be kind of a trailer. But we'll be talking about how evolution, in the sense of how the nature of love is to always evolve and to always grow and to always expand. It's not something that's always in the same place, and how that affects God himself. So God is in a constant process of becoming more and more in his experience of love, and therefore how our own potential in connection to God and love is ever evolving, and how even that becomes reflected in the material energy. So how all the different energies, including the energetic source, God himself, remain in a constant state of unfolding, which for me is a very important way of seeing reality instead of fixed substances that are already there and always the same, but something in constant movement. So tomorrow we'll try to share some thoughts about that. It will be 2 hours earlier than this meeting at 9 in the morning, our local time here. So if you have time, you are more than invited. It's not the same link. It's a different link, as you may have seen the flyer in social media. So looking forward to see you there. And one last announcement on this Wednesday, we'll be sharing another podcast after the one with Richard Rohr. This one will be with a very special friend of mine who lives in Vrindavan. He's a Vaishnava from the Nimbarka Sampradaya, scholar, very sweet devotee, called Naval Kishore Shastriji. And we had a very nice conversation on surrender. We talk on surrender today, and we'll talk on surrender on Wednesday with him. I mean, it was recorded. It will be shared that day. So also inviting you to check that out if you want. Thank you so much again for everything, for the everything that you are and your presence with that everything. And see you tomorrow, hopefully, or most lately as next Saturday. Sri Satchinanda Gaur Hari Ki Jai, Sri Hari Nam Prabhu Ki Jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Gaur Gadadhar Ju Ki Jai, Sri Sri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Radha Gopinath Ju Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol, Mancha Kalpatarubhyascha, Kripa Sindhubhyaiva Cha, Patitanam Pavanebhya Vaishnavebhya Namo Namah, Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Hari Hari Bol. Thank you so much. I have to turn off Bhakti Rasa, the recording. I think so. I never heard anything since. So anyhow, thank you so much to all of you. Again, Dandavat, pleasure to see you all.